Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking, I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Okay, welcome back to New Books in Jewish Studies. I'm your host, Max Kaiser. We have a great show for you today. With us, we have Brian K. Roby, fellow at the Center for Judaic Studies at the University of Michigan. He's here to talk to us about his new book, The Mizrahi Era of Rebellion, Israel's Forgotten Civil Rights Struggle, 1948-1966, published in 2015 by Syracuse University Press. Brian, thanks very much for being on the show.
Thank you for having me.
Great. So first off, could you just tell us a little bit about how you came to write this book?
Sure. So during my PhD, which I received from the University of Manchester, I was working on Middle Eastern history in general, with a particular focus on Israel. And a lot of what I read in terms of the literature did talk about kind of the discriminatory practices against Mizrahi or Sephardic or Middle Eastern Jews. But the kind of conclusion was that during the 50s and 60s, there wasn't much of a kind of a protest or a fight against discrimination or against inequality. And I sort of questioned it. I thought it was pretty strange, particularly like with the kind of popularity of the African-American civil rights movement. And in my research, I looked a lot at police reports and newspapers from the time. And what I found was like this wealth of information that was available that kind of showed you like the dynamics of Mizrahi protests, which included like sit-ins and hunger strikes. And a lot of the influence was based on both kind of like the independence movements in the Arab world, but also like Gandhi. People were also influenced by King and other like African-American civil rights leaders. So that's how I kind of started in terms of that.
Great. So can you give us a little bit of background about sort of the establishment of the State of Israel and who, you know, what basically the population makeup was and sort of the short little history of migration during this period? And then can you tell us a bit about your first chapter, which details the role of the Israel National Police during this period?
Mm-hmm. Sure. So the the establishment of the State of Israel in 1948, and as a result of the Arab-Israeli conflict, a lot of Jews from the Middle East, Africa, and Asia were either forced out or left because of persecution, forced out of their countries of origin and migrated to the State of Israel. Not everyone was Zionist. There were lots of Zionists involved in this from the Middle East. And when they arrived, a good portion of them were from Iraq and from a middle or upper class background. A lot of civil servants and well-educated people who spoke English and French. And they were placed in these transit camps called Ma'abarot. And in these transit camps, which they were only supposed to live in for a few months, they ended up living in for sometimes 6 years, 10 years. And they were often just tin shacks, sometimes just canvas tents. And so there was a lot of death and disease involved in that. And a lot of feelings of just being kind of oppressed because they came from a non-European background. At the time, there was the kind of state elite were mostly of European Jewish origin. And so there was this kind of like, you know, unequal balance between representation in the Knesset or the parliament and the people who were living in the country. So within like 5 or 6 years, or within 10 years, about 600,000 Jews from the Middle East had migrated to the state. And so just to get into my first chapter, what I did in that, I talked a lot about the Israel police because this was kind of the basis of my research kind of methods. And I looked at police reports and also the police kind of annual reports, which talked about the guiding principles. And what I found was that there was a concerted effort on the part of the Israel police to recruit Mizrahi Jews. And the purpose of that was that they assumed that if Mizrahi Jews were recruited into the police, they would become better integrated in society and also civilized to a certain extent. So there was this assumption that they all came from backwards countries and didn't know how to read or write and things like that. And so if they would engage with the police, who were mostly Ashkenazi Jews at the time, then they would learn like the kind of civilized way to behave. And so that's kind of the crux of the first chapter. And I talk a little bit about parallels between this project and also this project of civilizing and that of the American police force, which also had like kind of a similar goal in mind in terms of blacks and Irish, trying to integrate them into society through the police.
Great. So tell us a bit about what you call the foundations of the Mizrahi civil rights struggle in the first decade of Israel's existence. And what can you tell us about any attempts at solidarity between Mizrahi and Palestinian activists?
Sure. So in the second chapter, when I talk about the foundations of this movement or the struggle, I look at a couple of intellectuals, Avraham Abbas and Eliyahu Eliashar, the first of which, Avraham Abbas, was the Iraqi-born member of Knesset, and Eliyahu Eliashar was born in Mandate, Palestine, and was a lawyer and a kind of rights activist at the time. And I view this as the foundations of the struggle, mostly because a lot of what they were arguing with, they were saying there is discrimination and needs to be stopped before it gets worse. And part of that kind of intellectual, engagement with Knesset and also other different politicians was would form the basis of protests. So people would, have these protests either outside of the Sochnut, which is the Jewish agency, in one incident in front of the Knesset. And afterwards, Eliashar would write articles saying that, this is another example of kind of discrimination that's taking place against Mizrahi immigrants at the time. You also have an Indian intellectual who would write to the Jerusalem Post talking about this idea of the melting pot. So the melting pot in Israel was this, just like in America, was this idea that every immigrant would need to assimilate themselves into idealized westernized Israeli culture. And A.I. Makhmul is his name, the Indian intellectual. So he wrote that it's a great idea, but that needs to include the integration of, Asian and Arab culture as well, because this is also part of our roots as Jews, that we are rooted very much within the Middle East and Asia. In terms of solidarity efforts with Palestinians, I did find some instances, mostly through the Communist Party, of which a lot of Iraqi Jews took part in, whereas they would try to, have protests alongside Palestinians who were then living and under military rule. So I'm talking about civilians, not those that were living in Jordan or Lebanon at the time. And they would have these protests saying that, there needs to be an end to the military rule. And just like we live in these ma'barot or transit camps, they live in these kind of closed quarters and are segregated from society and kind of like, closed in from and not being able to kind of fulfill their goals. A lot of the other solidarity efforts were done within journals, which I looked at. So a lot of Mizrahi Jews would write in Arabic journals that were published by the socialist parties or by the Communist Party. And they were right alongside Palestinian poets and political activists and things like that, kind of demonstrating their, you know, strong affinities with the Arab world in a sense.
So tell us a little bit more about the transit camps that you talked about, and what sort of tactics were employed, tactics of resistance were employed within these transit camps.
One of the kind of fascinating tactics that I found were there were a lot of women and children who were involved in protests. So, and we're talking about teenagers here. So they would stage these protests within the Ma'abarot, and they would have like signs, or sometimes they'd take a bottle of drinking water and that was like, you know, dirty color, you know, colored with all kinds of contaminants and things like that, and you know, scream to the police or chant that, you know, this is the water that we drink, these are the tents that we live in, you know, see how you're treating us. In one case, there was a commission form within the Ma'abara in Pardes Chana, where they have a manifesto that they wrote and they delivered to the police and also to some politicians, where they outlined, you know, the kind of deprivation that they suffered from. So they would mention the fact that, you know, when there was someone who passed away, they wouldn't have rights to proper burial. They would have to wait days for someone to arrive. And sometimes the dead will be transported in garbage trucks and things like that. Women were not able to give birth in a hospital. They would either have to walk while in labor to miles in order to get to the nearest hospital, or they would just have to, you know, do it on their own. So you see a lot of kind of engagement in these particular protests in the Ma'abarot with the police, as the police would say, you know, they're the most visible manifestation of the state in a sense, because they're dealing on a daily basis one-on-one with the public. And there will be a lot of violent clashes with the police, in particular, if they felt as if the camp directors, who were mostly European Jews or Ashkenazim, if they felt that the camp directors would were kind of denying them rights or basic rights. So I think that hopefully answers your question in some way.
Yeah. And what was the tactic? And were the tactics different in the urban spaces that you talk about? And you also mentioned that there was both violent and non-violent tactics employed. Tell us a bit about this.
Correct, yeah. So I would say the main difference between the Ma'abara protests and the ones that took place in urban spaces were that they were much more well-organized, and they were much more dynamic, and they had different types of strategies. So whereas the ones in the Ma'abarot would have traditional types of protests, you would think, you know, people marching and kind of, you know, holding up signs and things like that. The ones in urban spaces would often directly, would go directly to a government building, sometimes even occupying a government building and conducting a sit-in and saying that, you know, in one particular case, which I kind of called the Be'er Sheva Rebellion, there was a group of Indian and Pakistani Jews who went to the Jewish agency and demanded to be sent back to India and Pakistan because of the racism that they faced. And they detailed it. And to a certain extent, a lot of them were successful. I think about 115 were flown back to Bombay, but the rest were not allowed to leave. And so this protest actually went on for 10 years, but it's just kind of like demonstrative of like the differences between the kind of Ma'abara protests and the urban ones. You asked another question. I can't remember.
Oh, about the violent and non-violent tactics.
Yes. So the more violent tactics would often occur as a result of police intervention. A lot of times they were like, people would hold like kind of peaceful protest, and they would have like democratic votes about, you know, who should go in to represent them to the municipality or to the government. And then the police would come, and they would often antagonize the protesters. And as a result of that, you know, there'd be clashes, people would get into arguments, and then things would get out of hand. So by out of hand, I mean, they would start, you know, raiding buildings or, you know, sometimes attacking the police. The police would often attack them as well, dragging women and kicking people and things like that. So what I found was that a lot of times that, you know, when the police were not involved, you know, these would continue to be nonviolent protests. The one thing I do want to point out is that in terms of the difference between the Mob Hurrah protests and the urban ones were that people did not have access to, Mizrahi immigrants didn't have access to cars and things like that. And they were often in very peripheral areas. So if they wanted to protest against the government or the Jewish agency, they would have to walk a lot of times for miles to Tel Aviv in order to do this. And so that added to the frustration. And especially like, you know, once they got there, they realized that, you know, the government was not willing to hear, you know, their pleas. They would get very angry.
Tell us, what was the Wadi Salib rebellion? And also, what was the sort of its ongoing impact?
Sure. So I'll start with its impact. The Wadi Salib rebellion is very important in Israeli history. So it's considered the first historiography of the Mizrahi protest. So in 1959, a Moroccan man was drunk at a cafe, and the police were called. And while they said they wanted to just fire a warning shot, they actually shot the man. And a lot of people mistakenly believed that he was killed at the time, but he was actually just taken to a hospital. And so following this, some local activists organized a protest that kind of sparked this major rebellion throughout the entire country. So it first started off in Haifa, in Wadi Salib neighborhood. And then once they protested in front of the police station, and they were brutally kind of like, you know, oppressed in a sense, and that they were attacked by the police. Then people heard of this and then started, you know, staging protests in Be'er Sheva and Jerusalem and Kiryat Melachi and other different towns and cities where there was a large Mizrahi presence. And so this is kind of marked as the pivotal point within which, you know, Mizrahim kind of, you know, protested against the government. And what I kind of showed was that, yes, it was a very important moment, but these protests, the Wadi Salib rebellion, was just the kind of culmination of like a decades long struggle for equality within the country. And as a result of this, I would say, I guess this is somewhat of the most successful in that it forced the government at the time to kind of come to terms with the fact that there is racism within the country. So a commission was formed called the Etzioni Commission, named after the judge, where it investigated, well, is there discrimination or not within Israeli society against Mizrahi immigrants or Mizrahi Jews? And they took testimony from people who were involved in the protests, people who led the protests, rabbis who were involved. And the government found that, no, there's not really discrimination, but if there is, then it's only really a few transit camp clerks or like a few different like secretaries that were involved in, you know, kind of denying people access to food or denying people access to good jobs or, you know, trying to relocate to a better city or a better, you know, better neighborhood. And so what I do want to point out, just to go back a little bit, is that in terms of its significance is that, you know, this occurred in 1959, and there's two markers in terms of Mizrahi protests previously for Israeli historians is that the Wadi Salib rebellion in 59, and then in 1971, there's the kind of emergence of the Black Panthers movement, where a group of young Jerusalemites, mostly from Morocco and Kurdistan, they formed a group, and they called it the Black Panthers after the American Black Panthers. And they kind of, these are the kind of the two points that were only really shown to be, you know, substantial Mizrahi protests, which I challenged in a sense.
Can you tell us a bit about your overall conclusions that you draw from your study? And you've already mentioned it a bit, but yeah, perhaps how it fits in with the historiography around this issue.
Right. So my kind of conclusions were, one, of course, you know, that the protests, which are often just kind of like referred to as like simple bread and work protests, because that was a common slogan at the time, they were a bit more than that. They were a lot more dynamic, and they were based on a kind of intellectual and political activism that was occurring at the time, and that the Wadi Salib rebellion, in a sense, was not the only protest. It was just a culmination of events that, you know, took place. Some other conclusions that I found was that based on what you see from the Arabic sources, from Mizrahi Jews, and from also from French and English sources, is that there's a lot of kind of parallels drawn between the Black struggle in America and the Mizrahi struggle in Israel. So in particular, Eliyahu Yashar would write a lot about, like, you know, what's going on, or what was going on in America, and how that relates to what was going on in Israel at the time. And he pointed to the Watts Rebellion. So this is a little bit later on in the 60s, where he points out that, you know, L.A. just had this major these major riots because of racism in the United States. And he notes that if discrimination continues within Israel, we're going to have a similar kind of riot that will take place, and that will, you know, spark a major flame within people's hearts. And this actually did take place. You can read about it a little bit more within my book. So kind of the overall gist of it was, you know, kind of looking at these parallels between the Black struggle, or kind of like showing that, you know, the Mizrahi protests at the time were very, you know, strong, and they were intellectually motivated. And that, you know, there was a lot of parallels between the African American struggle and the Israeli struggle for equality. Okay.
Well, thanks very much for talking to us about this really interesting and important book. Can you tell us a little bit about what you're working on next?
Yeah, sure. So while I'm at the Frankel Center here at the University of Michigan, I'm working on a project that looks more explicitly at this kind of African-American and Mizrahi parallels between the two and their history. So I'm looking mostly at the 60s and 70s. And one kind of article that I'm working on is looking at Black perspectives on the Mizrahi struggle. You know, did African-Americans who were involved in the civil rights movement at the time, did they look at Israel and say that, oh, yeah, we see that, you know, what's going on there is very similar to us? And what I found is, you know, yes, they did. Most famously, Martin Luther King was kind of involved in, he was invited on numerous visits to go to Israel. He never went, but from the sources that I found, he did have a lot of kind of like discussions with Israeli diplomats, mostly from the Israeli consulate in Atlanta, talking about, you know, what Blacks can learn from the experience of Mizrahim in Israel. And you see like Israeli politicians giving them suggestions and things like that about, you know, how to go about it, particularly talking about, you know, the supposedly successful integration of Mizrahim into Israeli society through the use of the army recruitment, police recruitment, and also like kind of major educational programs, particularly the Head Start program, which was started later on in the 70s. That was something that was lauded as a great idea that Blacks received from the Israeli state. And so then other projects that I'm working on in relation to that is kind of like looking at these parallels between the two groups, mostly within the idea, within the framework of migration. So at the same time that, you know, you have this mass migration from the Middle East of Jews to Israel, you have a migration of Blacks from the South of America going to northern cities. And what I see is that there's a lot of kind of discourse surrounding the promised land or the holy land. So you have Blacks who were referred to the North, you know, as the promised land. And of course, you have this, you know, very long history of, you know, the land of Israel being the holy land for Jews. And there's the same kind of the similar reaction on both parties, whereas they get to, you know, the Holy Land, and they're very disappointed because they think that they're escaping this kind of, you know, discrimination and persecution in their countries or regions of origin, only to find that they're facing the same discrimination in the Holy Land, but of a different type. And so there's one Iraqi writer, Meneshe Zarur, who wrote explicitly about this. And he said that, us Iraqi Jews, we came from, Iraq in order to flee the kind of oppression that was taking place there, only to find out that, we have this dual kind of oppression, both from the Iraqi state and the Israeli state, because now that we're in Israel, we're being treated as Middle Easterners. We're being treated badly because of that kind of label.
Well, they sound like really interesting projects. So we hope to have you back on the show to discuss further in the future.
Thank you.
Great. All right. Well, thanks very much for being on the show today with us. You've been listening to New Books in Jewish Studies with your host, Max Kaiser. Today with us, we had Brian K. Roby, fellow at the Center for Judaic Studies at the University of Michigan. He talked to us about his new book, The Mizrahi Era of Rebellion, Israel's Forgotten Civil Rights Struggle, 1948 to 1966. It was published in 2015 by Syracuse University Press. Thanks very much.